This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Sonny Bono of Sonny and Cher fame. And you may think of him as someone who needs no introduction, but you'd be wrong. And that's why I've invited Ben Vaughan to introduce Sonny. Ben is a rock musician, producer, collector, and he's one of the people on a forthcoming tribute to Sonny called Bonograph, the classic songs of Sonny Bono interpreted by today's hippest artists. So, Ben, why do you think Sonny Bono is so cool?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with his early years and the work he did behind the scenes before Sonny and Cher broke. He was an assistant for Phil Spector during the golden years of Spector's career. He played percussion on a lot of the songs, and he also worked as an A&R man for Specialty Records, which was a great R&B label that had Little Richard, Larry Williams, and Don and Dewey. And few people know that. He also was a great songwriter back then. He wrote Needles and Pins, which was a big hit for the Searchers, and he wrote She Said Yeah, which the Rolling Stones covered. And of course, Bang Bang, and I Got You, Babe, and everything. And he was a great producer, too. I mean, pardon me if I go on, but what he did with Sonny and Cher really was combine the Spector Walls sound with folk rock, which was just emerging at the time. And he was the only person who really had the foresight to bring folk rock even further into pop music with the orchestral things that Spector already had going. So he combined the two, and I Got You, Babe, is a perfect example.
So you don't think of Sonny Bono as a joke?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Of course, he did a whole lot to kind of become a joke with the television show later on and everything. I think he basically lost interest in producing and writing and concentrated on a show business career, which is kind of, you know, a whole different career, the way I see it. But as a musician and a writer and a producer, I think he was very talented.
Okay, thanks, Ben. We're going to meet Sonny in a second. He's got a new autobiography called And the Beat Goes On.
The beat goes on, the beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da. Charleston was once the rage,
Sonny Bono, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you before we start talking about your career, if you think that there are certain stereotypes that people have of you.
Yes. I think that when a show's on the air and as popular as the Sonny and Cher show is, and you play a character, people, and the character's believable, then they believe that character. And so that kind of is who they think you are. And I'm sure that's happened to me.
So who is that? What is the idea people have of you?
Well, I think basically from that show, the character that I played was a straight man, kind of a doofus, the guy that took the brunt of the shots. So I think it was a lovable character and warm and likable, but that was the guy. I think it was a doofus kind of thing.
You're in politics now, but are you writing songs anymore or singing anywhere?
I just built a studio in Palm Springs. I just finished it about a week ago. So all the new things they have musically now is I find fascinating. And where we had to go through so much to produce a record now, you can do it in an office as big as a closet and come out with a symphonic orchestra. So I'd like to dabble in that a little bit. So I built a studio. And I have all the equipment necessary now to produce, so I'll see what comes up. I don't know if my frame of mind's there or if my head's there, because I do enjoy politics.
So have you been writing?
I've written a little bit. I've written a couple songs, but nothing that I'm flipped over or nothing that I feel clicked like I did when I wrote The Beat Goes On or I Got You. Nothing has hit me like those songs, but maybe it'll come back in.
Well, let's talk about how you got your start. Your idol when you were growing up was Frankie Lane.
And yeah.
I'll confess to you, I was a big fan of his, too. But for me, it was Cuss of, like, Rawhide.
Oh.
I thought he sang that so well, you know.
He got into that.
Yeah, really. So you wrote your first song with Frankie Lane in mind.
Yeah. Frankie Lane was the hot number when I was a kid in school, and he was the kind of real stylist then. So he had this sexy kind of drawl. I patterned everything after Frankie Lane. When I wanted to sing, I tried to imitate him. And then I wanted to, when I wanted to write, I wanted to write for Frankie Lane. And by the time I started writing songs, though, Frankie Lane got cold, as we say in show business. So even if he could get a song to him, it didn't mean too much in that day.
So you tried to get a song to him?
Yeah, I did. I in fact did get a song to him. I think what he did, and he liked it very much. I think what he didn't, the part I didn't know, by then I was, 19 or 20, what I didn't know was that he was cold and he couldn't get a recording contract himself, but he owned a record, little independent record company.
And you got a job at that company and that led you to other record companies.
Well, I was just a writer there. And that was Crystal Records. I was just a songwriter, and they liked all the songs I wrote, so they would see me often and see what I had. And my two stops when I went to Hollywood would be, I used to deliver meat, and I'd stop at two record companies mainly because of my reception. I'd stop at Specialty Records and Crystal Records. And Specialty Records, they liked my material as well. But Specialty was a very successful label. They had Little Richard, Don and Dewey. Then they had Sam Cooke as a soul stirrer then. He wasn't Sam Cooke. He was one of the soul stirrers. But they were they had Lloyd Price, Percy Mayfield, all these blues artists. So they were very successful as an independent label, incredibly successful.
Well, when you got a job at Specialty Records, one of your songs, one of your first songs, was recorded by the group Don and Dewey, the rhythm and blues duo.
Yeah.
And the song was Coco Joe, and this is a song about the coolest monkey in town.
Yeah, right.
What led you to write the song?
Well, when I was a box boy at a store, they came out with a Coco Joe, and I thought, oh, what a great name, Coco Joe. And so I write this real cute little Calypso song, you know, because Calypso was happening, Belafonte was happening. That was when I was about 17. And then I get to Specialty, and I sing it for Don and Dewey, and they are two raving hardcore blues singers. And so this little, in the jungle there's a monkey, that's the way that I sang it. And they go, in the jungle there's a monkey, bam, you know. And I never heard a song change personality so much in my life. Then later on, the Righteous Brothers recorded it. So actually, that was... probably the first or second song that I wrote.
Well, let's give it a spin.
Okay.
In the jungle, there's a monkey named Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey that you ever know. He don't have a tail like the other monkeys do. He trimmed it in suede and it dyed it blue. Coco Joe, let me tell you about a Coco Joe. With a crazy drink, you should see his walk, it's the funniest thing. He changed the stroll to the monkey swing. Coco Joe, now let me tell you about a Coco Joe. Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey in town.
Was it hard as a 22-year-old producer to work with a kind of wild rhythm and blues group like you were?
No, it was fascinating and fun. I loved it. I loved black music because that was they were much more liberal about what you wanted to sing or who you were or what your intention was. You know, in that day, Decca and Capitol and Brunswick and RCA were the hot labels, and they just had an attitude about music, and it had to be the certain thing. So it was like the big companies now. You couldn't get in. So, but you went to these black artist labels, you know, they were very flexible, very liberal, and allowed you to be. And so they overcame the music industry because of their attitude, but these the black labels were that way. And you know, I first started with Johnny Otis, who let me record on his label, which was Dig Records, you know, and that was the first song I wrote called Ecstasy. So being in that environment with Little Richard and Don and Dewey and Larry Williams, I was in heaven, just absolute heaven.
My guest is Sonny Bono. He's written an autobiography called And the Beat Goes On. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sonny Bono. Now, I'll confess, I just found out this week that you wrote Needles and Pins, and I feel bad. Like I should have known that you wrote that and should have, like, given you credit that for that, you know, in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people, of all the songs I've written, that song, people go, I didn't know you wrote that.
Yeah.
I thought Jackie DeShannon wrote that.
Well, so, I always just think of The Searchers, you know. I don't even think of Jackie DeShannon.
Yeah, nobody makes the association. So you're not alone.
So did you work on the lyrics?
I worked on it both.
You worked on both?
It was me and Jack Nitzsche, and I had hired Jack Nitzsche to write lead sheets for Specialty Records, and then we became very, very close, and we were like family to his family, and my family hung out together all the time. So we'd talk about music and for days and hours and hours and days and months. That's all we talked about. And Jack could play a piano pretty well, you know, and so he had this riff, you know, do 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 do, and he just couldn't get it out of mind. He goes, I love this riff. So one night we had nothing to do, so it wasn't planned or preconceived. So we started fooling around, and then Needles and Pins came out, and pretty soon we had a whole song. So we just kind of assembled it, whatever parts we could contribute. So nobody specifically went to lyrics or music.
Well, the question I always wanted answered about Needles and Pins was whether you wrote Needles and Pinza. You know, now it begins.
Yeah.
Well, where did that extra syllable come from?
The Pinza. You're always looking for little hooks, what we call hooks when you write, you know. And it also comes from... I kind of always tried to fancy myself as a blues singer, if I could sing, and so blues singers always kind of added these little extra syllables to words or phrased differently. So it was a phrasing that I had, and then Jackie DeShannon heard that phrasing, and she just jumped right on it.
Now, you worked with Phil Spector for a while,
yeah,
as a promo man, and then helping him with production. As a promo man, what was your style in getting airplay on stations? I imagine it wasn't hard to get those records airplay.
It was a piece of cake. I mean, all I had to do was take a record into the station. When I was a promotion man for Philip, he was as hot as he could be, and they couldn't wait to get the next Phil Spector record. So, fortunately, I didn't have to do anything except... get the record to the radio station.
Everyone who's ever worked with Phil Spector has great Phil Spector stories. One that you tell that I especially like in your new book is about how Spector would always practice looking cool. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Philip was the most unique creature I ever met in my life, especially at that time, because in the early 60s, all the things that were standardized were so embedded, nobody thought in different form other than what was standard, you know. So when you were a singer, you dressed standard. You had the little short suit with the string tie, and the whole world then was pretty conformed. So I get a job with Philip, and I meet this little guy who's just a total nonconformist. His hair was long. He dressed in the most bizarre fashion, and he produced in the most bizarre fashion. Before I wanted to work with Philip because I wanted to see how this guy produced. Up until then, when I produced, I'd have one piano, one guitar, two saxophones or whatever. And here you go in the studio, and there's three pianos lined up. four guitars lined up, three drummers lined up, and I go, my God, what is going on here? You know, three percussionists, and then a whole sax section. So that was one session. I never saw anything like it in my life. So everything that Philip did was revolutionary. And when he recorded, he'd be wearing sunglasses, and he was just totally cool. And he was always aware that he was a performer. Philip really wanted to be the star. Anybody that sang really was an offshoot of Philip. So he was the star of his label, not the artist. You know, Darlene Love really didn't get that much recognition. Even Ronnie, it was Philip who was the real star. You know, so this guy lived that way. The funniest time I ever had with him trying to impress us was we shopped at the market on Vine Street, which was a big market, at 12 o'clock, and he was a weird looking guy, and people looked at him, and pretty soon I was weird looking too, because I wanted to be like Philip. And so he studied French lessons a little bit, so he said to me, he gave me French words to answer back to him, as he wanted us to pretend we were two French people in this market. And so he gave me French words to say back to him when he would say sentences. And so he'd say a sentence, and I'd absolutely screw up the response, because I think the most difficult language in the world was French. But here we are in a supermarket, two idiots, dressed bizarre, speaking French, hoping people would notice us. And that was Phil's style.
Among the many things you did was backup vocals for some of Spector's records. And you write that he used to call you his funk. Why?
Well, I have kind of a froggy voice, or I have a real nasally voice, and it cuts through everything. And so it's not a very smooth sound, but he liked it because it wasn't a smooth sound, and he thought it was funky, and it did cut through on the background. So I sang with the Blossoms and all the girls, and then later Cher joined me, and he liked that background sound, and he liked my voice in there. So when I hear the records today, Mary, I can still hear me, and so can my wife, Mary.
After working on production and promotion in the record industry, what made you think about becoming a performer yourself?
I always wanted to perform. As long as I could remember, I wanted to be in some form of show business. It's the only thing that ever really interested me. So however I could figure out a way to perform, I would try singing, but I really didn't have the pipes to be a singer. Or then I tried writing. And I just stayed in it, and I was good enough to sustain in the industry because I loved it so much that I could pull it off. So I just, as long as I could ever remember, I wanted to perform.
When you met Cher, you became a couple, and you performed together. You started off performing as Caesar and Cleo. What was the angle behind the names?
The angle then, in the 60s, you know, they had Dick and Dee Dee, Chubby Checker. Part of being an artist then was to come up with a gimmicky name as well. So nobody really had their real names. They always had these hook name, what we call hook names. So that was right when Cleopatra came out with Liz Taylor, and my haircut was as close, the closest thing they could call a haircut like mine then was a Caesar cut. And so, and Cleopatra was out, and I went, all right, Caesar and Cleo, that's got to be a hitting formula. What a great name. So that bombed real fast.
So when you became Sonny and Cher instead of Caesar and Cleo, how was Sonny and Cher different?
We were just a little more honest, and by then I think I had a little more awareness after watching Phil of how to approach a commercial market and how to write for it and how to produce for it. So I was much more on as a producer and arranger and songwriter. So I wrote "Baby Don't Go" for Cher and with me doing the background, and it was a pretty commercial song, and I kind of felt it was right on. And when I wrote it, I left Phil, and I borrowed $135, and that's how much that record cost.
Wasn't the idea initially for you to produce Cher, but she wouldn't? She was too nervous to sing by herself, so you ended up singing with her?
Yeah. Cher wanted to sing so badly, and I always wanted Phil to record her when he was singing background, but they got along like a dog and a cat. And so he would never record her except for Ringo, I Love You. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a quick brainstorm that Philip had when the Beatles emerged on the scene.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, and he called Cher Bonnie Joe Mason. So there is a record somewhere called Ringo, I Love You by Bonnie Joe Mason, and that's Cher singing of Phil's brainstorm. And that bombed. Then I left, and I wanted to, because Phil just wouldn't record Cher, so I left, and then I wrote Baby Don't Go, and she didn't like singing alone. She was really petrified of singing in those days. She was petrified of performing, and believe it or not, she still is. And so she felt more comfortable if I was out there singing with her. So I just sang the choruses on Baby Don't Go. And it became a what we called the soft hit. It hit in California in the West Coast, but it wasn't a national hit. But it was enough to get a career rolling for us.
My guest has been Sonny Bono, and we'll hear more about Sonny and Cher in the second part of our interview on tomorrow's program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.